I don't buy every conspiracy theory out there. In fact, you might say I'm a curious skeptic. But there is just enough evidence to consider the possibility that the powers that be are manipulating us like so many pawns on a chessboard. That's why we hear the theories out on Jim Harold's Conspiracy Corner. Welcome to the Conspiracy Corner. I am Jim Harold, and so glad to be with you again. Now, when we talk about conspiracies, we may talk about, a lot of times, individual conspiracies. Things like the JFK assassination, the RFK assassination, the MLK assassination. Various events throughout history that make you think, well, maybe there was some kind of conspiracy involved with that singular event. Today we have a guest who I think would say that not only in some of the things I mentioned there were some conspiracies, but all of the conspiracies are linked somehow. And we're so glad to have him with us. And I will apologize in advance. I will probably totally butcher his name, but we'll do our best. Ole Damagard, we're so glad to have him with us. His website is lightonconspiracies.com. He has been studying this type of subject matter for over 30 years, and he has been on numerous television and radio programs talking about his various theories. And again, you can find his work at lightonconspiracies.com. Ole, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Jim, and it's an absolute pleasure.
I have to ask this question because I always wonder this when I talk to somebody who, you know, theorizes about conspiracies. And we talk about the phrase conspiracy theorist and conspiracy theory. Why do you think that phrase has gotten such a kind of bad reputation? Is it part of the conspiracy itself?
No, it was expression was made up just after the JFK assassinations to disarm any kind of critics. And the whole idea is that we've been so bombarded over these decades of years with combining the two words. You never hear the word conspiracy almost without the word theory afterwards. Right. And as soon as it's a theory, there's a doubt involved. I'm not involved in conspiracy theories. I'm interested in conspiracy facts. That's the only thing that counts for me. And so I'm a former journalist. I've been doing this for 30 years. It's cost me dearly. I lost a couple of friends. I had to leave my home country and so on. So the things I'm going to put forward has not sort of come to me easily, or it's not just empty words put out there.
If we're talking about a grand conspiracy, it has to be pretty large. How large is the scope of what you think you've uncovered?
The group behind them, very small. The conspiracy, very big. Very, very big. If the things that you mentioned, I can just go back a bit in time, because the first, in the early 80s, I became very interested in the JFK assassination. Mm-hmm. At that time, I was working as a journalist and so on. I just got more or less obsessed with the whole case because, for one thing, it's so complex and multi-layered, but also it was so obvious on an early stage that we were being totally lied to, because it's so obvious once you start looking into this with a open mind that there's an actual conspiracy going on here, that there was more than one shooter and so on. And whatever the official story was that was put forward, nothing made sense if you really look into it. So that one took me down a long road. I think I read a couple of hundred books. This was way before the age of the internet, so this type of information was not so easy to come across. And then that area got me very interested in the Robert Kennedy assassination as well, and Malcolm X and Martin Luther King, Abraham Lincoln, and so on. And then in 1986, the Swedish Prime Minister, Olof Palme, was gunned down in the streets of Stockholm. And at that time, I thought I lived in a beautiful democracy, you know, Sweden, we're being pumped with this being the perfect world, no corruption, no, you know, you can trust the police, you can trust the government, all of these things. But what I found was that over the years that I've studied the JFK and Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy. And so it was almost like there was some kind of template starting to become visible in all this fog around surrounding these cases. And this template was, I tracked it down to the old Romans, how they were able to carry out conspiracies or assassinations on a top level and dupe the population into thinking that it was the work of a lone crazy guy. And the reason why they always wanted to be a lone crazy guy is because if he was alone, by law, there was no conspiracy. A conspiracy is when two or more people are involved in some kind of hidden agenda to create damage to a third party. So if he's alone, no conspiracy. And if he's crazy, then no motive. You know, so that's why they just want case closed right away, bury the guy, kill him, whatever, just get rid of him so that nobody will start looking into what would be the real truth behind these things.
Well, if you look at something like the JFK assassination, the one thing that is a real head scratcher to me about the whole thing is Jack Ruby. If you think about it, you know, the guy had mob ties. Apparently, he was known to, I believe he was known to Nixon. He was known to Johnson. If you think about, and I remember the way that, you know, from my childhood, I remember watching a TV movie about the JFK assassination and where they dramatized everything. And they said, well, Ruby was just a really upset guy. He really loved Kennedy. So he was completely, gobsmacked to borrow a phrase from our British friends about it, and was just so upset that he felt that he had to exact revenge. And if you look at his background and so forth, that's just the silliest, the silliest kind of cover story. I mean, there had to, and the fact that he got into the police station so easily, you know, with the at that point, the criminal of the century. And he just waltzed into the police station, even though he was obviously known by the Dallas police. So to me, you know, that's kind of the thing, the flag out there that's saying, wait, something is up here.
I tell you, Jim, once you start looking into these assassinations, especially the JFK one, in great detail, you will just find that there are thousands of things that are just so, so wrong. And Jack Ruby or just an explanation like that is just like so silly, you know, it's really stupid. It's like the official story of the Swedish prime minister, how he was shot down. The official story to this day, very much similar to the Oswald story, but it was that he was an alcoholic, the Swedish guy, and that he went up. He thought that the Swedish prime minister was his drug dealer. So he went up behind him a Friday evening and just shot him dead. And this guy was died later under very strange circumstances after having been taken care of by the police. And, take care of them, get rid of the patsy, so end of story. So, I mean, these official explanations are just so bad. And when you look into the JFK assassination, it is so complex and so multi-layered. But I would like to take you down a row, down a bit back in history, if
sure.
I can do that.
Absolutely.
And start tying these things together. Because in the late 50s and early 1960s, Alan Dulles, he was one of the lawyers that was helping Hitler in his war machine, together with Prescott Bush. That was the dad of George Bush Sr. Prescott Bush was one of the guys helping to fund Hitler, not from his own pocket, but the guy that carried the money, sort of pushed the money from different finances around the world and into IG Farben and other industries that was building up the whole background around the Hitler Nazi war machine. And Alan Dulles was one of the lawyers for Hitler. He later was very much involved in Operation Paperclip, where they exported many of these hardened Nazis into the States and into South America. And then he was part of creating what is called OSS, which was then what would later to become the CIA. Okay, now this Alan Dulles was part of coming up with the idea of creating a super team of assassins, an ultra-secret team of assassins that could be used globally to take out whoever they had problems with. So this was approved of by President Dwight Eisenhower, and the task was given to Richard Nixon to create this. So Vice President Nixon, he contacted some CIA veterans, one of them, David Attlee Phillips. He was the one of the things he was the controller of Lee Harvey Oswald. He was also the controller of James Files, who was one of the shooters in the assassination. And he was also the controller of a man by the name of Michael Van Townley, who was later, 23 years later, very central in the assassination of the Swedish prime minister, and many, many, many other. I'm going to tie them together. But this David Attlee Phillips, very central in this. He was later advanced all the way up to the very top of the CIA as the chief of the covert operation of the Western Hemisphere. I mean, big time player. Another guy was Ted Shackley, also known as the Blonde Ghost. He had a similar career as David Attlee Phillips and also central in so many, many, many assassinations. So these two, together with E. Howard Hunt, who is quite famous later for the Watergate burglary and other stuff, were put together to recruit people to this team of assassins. And they went down to Miami, and most of the people they recruited were exiled Cubans who had just fled from Cuba after that Castro took over the island and threw everybody out, threw the mob out, threw all the casinos, all the companies, foreign companies, everybody out. And this whole gambling scene on Cuba and the drugs coming from that direction were massive income for the mob, the government, and these secret structures behind many of the atrocities we're going to talk about. So they really wanted Fidel Castro out. So the first thing for this team of assassins were they were recruited to take out the beard. And they recruited about 85 people. These were mostly former Cuban policemen from the Air Force, Cuban Air Force. Some of them were secret agents from the Batista regime on Cuba. And, well, soldiers, very violent people, highly skilled when it came to causing mayhem. And so they were trained in Miami, down in Florida, you know, in the swamps down there, mm-hmm. also in Louisiana, outside New Orleans, Lake Pontchartrain. And they were also trained in Guatemala. They were trained in everything from jungle warfare to blowing up things to poison, you name it. As long as it would kill someone, they were trained in it. So, but the key master for this group was a man by the name of George Herbert Walker Bush. That's George Bush Sr. He was the guy that was put there to fund the whole group. Once again, not from his own money, but from oil tycoons in Texas, from the military industrial complex, from the mob and so on. These were the money was pumped into this team. And when you look at this team and the members of these groups, this has been very secret over the years, but it's taken me 30 years to expose many of these members. And it's just absolutely mind-blowing once you see who the members were and some of the things they carried out, because they have been very active for a long time. They went under the name of Operation 40, and there were around 85 men and one woman. Now, if you look at they tried to take out Fidel Castro. They failed a couple of times there. And then after the Cuban Missile Crisis, when suddenly Kennedy totally turned against whoever helped him to come to power, after sitting with a finger on the button, almost being the one to cause the Third World War. I think that he was at that point, that was a real change in his life when he just discovered the absolute magnitude of the madness that was involved in this whole thing. And he just said, I refuse to be the one that caused this type of damage to the world. And after that date, he suddenly became this very powerful individual that was going to change the world. He was going to splinter the CIA into 1,000 pieces. He was going to get rid of the Federal Reserve Bank. He was going to withdraw out of Vietnam, a war that hadn't even started on the American behalf. And he was going to, you know, just get the whole country back in balance, get rid of all the, also track down, hunt down, actually, the mob. He put his brother Bobby Kennedy to just start a witch hunt on the mob. And this caused a lot of anger because especially the Chicago mob, Sam Giancana, had helped Kennedy's father to get JFK into a position where he was elected. It was the closest election ever, I think, just 100,000 votes between Nixon and JFK. And it was with the help of the Chicago mob that that got him into position. So when he turned on them as well, he upset a lot of people. There were many other causes than just these, but that was the thing that just enough is enough. So many, many people wanted to get rid of him.
It's interesting because if you think about it, it really he did make a lot of enemies. You talk about the Cuban exiles. They were, you know, aside from, you know, monies being lost and so forth, and the loss of their homeland, of course, a lot of, I think, Cuban exiles felt very strongly that Kennedy had left them out to dry the Bay of Pigs invasion by not providing more support. And then you look... I believe Kennedy was one of the few people to print non-Federal Reserve notes, United States notes, and I think the other one was Abraham Lincoln.
That's one of the things they've got in common.
Yeah, and then another thing is you talk about splintering the CIA into 1,000 pieces. I believe that that's a direct quote from Kennedy himself. He said that he wishes that he could have split it into 1,000 pieces, and I think it is pretty well known that he made kind of a more detente kind of turn after the Cuban Missile Crisis because it was such a horrifying event. So, I mean, it does make sense that he made a lot of enemies, and not to mention, and this is one of the most interesting things, I think, and we may do a show on this angle specifically with another guest soon, is that you have a vice president who is extremely ambitious and who is on the cusp of being ruined by some revelations. So it seems like the perfect storm to kind of meet the fate that JFK met.
Yeah, because Lyndon Johnson was going down. He was facing jail big time, very shortly. Had JFK not been taken out, Lyndon Johnson was going down within.
And people think that that is just something somebody made up. That is absolutely true. In fact, I can tell you, I was listening to the American journalist Jeff Greenfield, who is totally mainstream, believe me, and he would be horrified about his name being mentioned on a show that talks about conspiracy. But even he, in one of his recent books, talked about the whole thing with Johnson being on the firing line and not surviving, being basically, you know, kicked off the ticket. I don't know the exact phrasing that he used, but he talked about this whole scandal piece that was going to come out, I think, in Life magazine within a few weeks. And then who knows where it would have led. He probably would have ended up a lot like Spiro Agnew did a decade later. In disgrace. So he had a reason to want JFK off of the scene. Not only to get power, but just survival.
The thing was that he was, the very day that JFK was shot, I think it was the exact same day, his case was being delivered, you know, because he was being accused of, I think, 8 different assassinations, murders, one of them being his own sister, to get into the power position that he was. You know, and there were lots of fraud. There was lots of very, very, I mean, he was a very criminal person, this guy. And one of the guys who had helped him into power was John Connally, Governor John Connally, mm-hmm. that was actually in the same limo. Lyndon Baines Johnson's very central in the whole thing. There was a meeting the evening before the assassination as well, where Lyndon Baines Johnson was invited to Clint Murchison's ranch just outside Dallas. And one of the other people, that was where they got the final go-ahead for the operation. And one of the other people that flew in that night was J. Edgar Hoover, the chief of the FBI, who was also his career was also about to end had JFK lived. So both of these two were very, very much involved in getting rid of him. Because now, as soon as Kennedy was dead, Lyndon Johnson got to this become a president. He would never have gone there otherwise. Prison was the only way forward for him had JFK not died. And J. Edgar Hoover had been fired as soon as JFK had been reelected, because so they really wanted to stop him. But there were so many different people around JFK that wanted him dead for their personal reasons. And anyway, but if we go back to this team of assassins, because I just want to point out some of the members, and you will see them in world history popping up everywhere, you know. Like the shooters, maybe you, if you want to do a separate show just on a JFK assassination, I can go through all the shooters as far as I know, where they were positioned, the breakdown guys, the walkie-talkie, who drove the escape cars and so on. But a main part of the shooters, because this was an unholy alliance between the mob, the Secret Service, the CIA, and the military-industrial complex. You know, it was like everybody that wanted him dead was part of this, and what they did was they all supplied shooters. And one of this, the main group of these shooters were from Operation 40. There were people like, if you want to, I can do a quick run through. Okay. Mm-hmm. If you, I hope your listeners know about Dealey Plaza, the layout and so on.
Yes.
If we go to the Deltex building, the people, according to my research, the people inside the Deltex building, second floor, just behind, underneath the fire stair, the shooter was a man by the name of Chucky Nicoletti. He was Sam Giancana, the Chicago mobsters, one of his lieutenants and a major hitman. He was the shooter. The spotter, because they normally work in pairs of two or three, in teams of two or three, normally there's one shooter. He should only focus on the shot, nothing else. The spotter takes care, he's with binoculars and radio, takes care, checks out everything before and after so that they can escape and get away. And then sometimes there's a breakdown guy as well who takes care of, he breaks down the rifle. As soon as the shots are fired, the rifle is thrown to him. He breaks it down into pieces, down in a bag or something like that. At least he gets rid of it in another direction than the shooter himself. And he also takes care of should there be any evidence or shell cases, anything like that. But in this assassination, there's most of the time two. Okay, so it's Chucky Nicoletti was the shooter, and the spotter was a man by the name of Tony Izquierdo, or Nestor Izquierdo. He was a close member to Operation 40, a black former a close associate to Operation 40. There's actually a statue of Tony Izquierdo in Miami today. And there were Hale Braden, that was an L.A. mobster. His only task was to let the team in from the backside of the Deltex building in and up into the office that was actually owned by a mining company that was a front for the CIA. In that room as well were no one less than George Herbert Walker Bush, if I'm correct, and many other researchers. He was there when the shots were fired. And the last person in there was Johnny Rosselli. Johnny Rosselli was a former hitman from Al Capone, but he was also the liaison between the mob and the CIA. He was the guy. He had also a lot of contacts in Hollywood and so on. So these were the people in the Deltex building. Now we go to the Texas School Book Depository. On the floor where Oswald is said to have been, by the way, Lee Harvey Oswald, totally innocent. Actually, I would say a hero, trying to stop the whole assassination. He was the guy who sent out telegrams to the FBI warning about this. He did everything he could to stop it, but instead he was the guy who had to take the fall for it. But on the same floor where he's supposed to be, there were three people. There were Eladio Del Valle, a former Batista agent, he was part of Operation 40, and he was the guy who was later murdered the same day as Dave Ferry, if you remember the JFK movie and so on.
Yeah.
He was the guy found with they split his head. So Eladio Del Valle, and then the next one, a black man called Herminio Diaz Garcia, part of Operation 40, a highly skilled assassin that was involved in many other assassinations and later killed in Mexico City. And then the second shooter that was in the absolute opposite end of the Texas School Depository, same floor though, was Richard Kane, a former Chicago police, but later, or he was already the right hand of Sanjian Khanna from the Chicago mob. And by the way, this day Sanjian Khanna was at the Adolphus Hotel, just down the road on the main street, just a few hundred meters. He was booked in there together with Richard Kane. And you can see after the shots are fired, these people get down from the sixth floor and out on the back of the Texas School Book Depository. Three of them gets into a car, drives off in Ruth Payne cars, driven by David Morales. I'm going to get back to him. And then Richard Kane starts running down Houston Street and takes off towards down Main Street. I would say towards the Adolphus Hotel, where I believe that the whole operation was controlled from, the technical center sort of that controlled the whole operation. I believe that that was in the Adolphus Hotel. But anyway, so you got these people, and I believe that the reason why nobody observed them getting down from that floor, because there were people in the stairs and the elevator, the lift, was just before the shooting, the electricity was turned off and the elevator was blocked, the lift was blocked. But I believe that they, since they were trained in jungle warfare, that they just had ropes and I don't know what you call it, jumped down on the inside in the elevator shaft, mm-hmm. and then got out on the back of the building. This is also, if Lee Harvey Oswald had any part of this, his task would have been to control so that nobody tried to use the elevator. And that is exactly where he was later observed by the police, you know, drinking the Coca-Cola. That is right by the elevator. Anyway, so we go down to the towards the grassy knoll. You have down in front of just where the Stemmons Highway freeway sign is, there's this called the Umbrella Man. There was a big mystery around this man with a black umbrella. His name, as far as I know, was Roy Hargraves, very closely connected to Operation 40, a mercenary. And his task was to mark the point, the cross point, for the different teams to know when to start shooting, because they couldn't have, like, people shoot during 20 seconds. You could never blame that on one single guy if there were, like, so many shots. So everybody had to shoot at the same time. And then that could be blamed on echo and whatever. So his task was just to mark that point. Now, the guy in front of him, it's a dark Cuban-looking guy. His name was Felipe Vidal Santiago. He steps out in the street almost, you know, they say that he waves to the president. I think that he was part of trying to slow it down as well. So, but Felipe Vidal Santiago, who was also close to Operation 40, later worked for many years for the CIA under the alias of Charles Morgan. He was working for a company, a CIA front company called ITT, and one of his tasks was to go out in internationally, depending on what country somebody was being planned to be taken out. He was there to recruit people on a local on a local basis, you know, people as patsies or people to get involved. And he was in Stockholm just a few months before the Olof Palme assassination, the fall of 1985, trying to recruit assassins to be part of the Olof Palme assassination. One, here again, a direct connection from Dallas to the killing 23 years later in Stockholm. Okay, on the other side of the street, when you look at the Zapruder film, if you don't look at the car, look above it, and there you will see there's a man in khaki trousers and shirt, mm-hmm. and he's got a big, big bulletproof vest on. It's unreal when you start seeing how obvious it is, but all of us have just been looking at the limo, as far as I know, the motor cage. Look at this guy, and you will see just when Kennedy raises his hand up to his throat, he is racing. He's like in a tactical stand with what looks to be a small weapon. If he fired or not, I'm not sure, but I have a very credible witness that claims that this man is, his name is Walter Tobinski, and he was... he and his accomplice, a man by the name of Clyde Forshaw, both of them residents of Toronto today, have been used as head cleaners for the American government, the Canadian government, the mob, and all other sources as well. They are some of the people that have been part of clearing out so many witnesses, so many people over the years that have known too much or have been trying to expose it or so on. And they are said to have more than 1,000 lives each on their CV, you know. Very violent people.
One of the interesting things about the Kennedy assassination, and actually Richard Belzer, with a co-author, came out with a book not that long ago called Hit List. And he went over the famous American comedian and also a conspiracy researcher, we'll say. And he talked about the certain amount of people, I can't remember if it was 50 or 100, or it was a lot of people. And I know there's even more that he didn't get into. And the strange circumstances surrounding their death shortly after the Kennedy assassination, and the kind of circumstances that just didn't make a lot of sense. Now, let me ask you this, because the Kennedy assassination, we could talk about it for hours, and it is, you know, really just kind of like the center point for a lot of this stuff. But one assassination that I think doesn't get paid nearly as much attention to, even though some could argue that its implications were almost as great, was the RFK assassination on the other end of the 60s, and just the strangeness behind that with the supposed lone nut again, Sirhan, but just very odd how Kennedy was routed through one way as opposed to, I think they changed the route on him too. And talk to us about that assassination, because that one, I think, is kind of, you know, not paid as much attention to, but had a lot of implications for American and world history.
It has, because in my opinion, the assassination of JFK was a brutal, brutal takeover of a group, a power group that are still in power to this very day, I would say. And all the rest of the presidents since the JFK assassination are being part of this group. I would humbly suggest that JFK was the last real elected president. All the rest of these guys have been just a front face of this same very, very brutal war machine that took over that day. And that is why I put such an effort into exposing what's going on, because it's still affecting our lives major, major. When it comes to the RFK assassination, he was not many people know that the Martin Luther King assassination and the Robert Kennedy assassination was just a month apart, and that there was a major chance, I would say, that Robert Kennedy would be elected as a president and maybe with Martin Luther King as a vice president. And that would have been like a death stroke to this global cabal. You know, that would really have made a massive problem. So they got rid of Martin Luther King, hoping that that would scare off Robert Kennedy as well. But he just continued, and so they decided to take him out also. And if you remember, I mentioned a name, a man by the name of David Morales. He was one of the key top officers in Operation 40 and connected with the CIA. He was later named the top assassin in South America. They're very, very, very crucial in many, many of these coup d'etats that happen in South America and so on. But he was in Dealey Plaza this day. He was the one driving Ruth Payne's car, picking up the shooters from behind the Texas School Book Depository. And he was also present at the Ambassador Hotel 1968, together with two other CIA officials that were there to supervise the whole operation. Not there as shooters, but to supervise the whole thing. Another of these were Gordon Campbell, and the other one was George, with a Greek name. I always forget it, but these were the three people from the CIA there. Now, David Morales was later on sent to South America to track down Che Guevara, together with a man called Felix Rodriguez. Felix Rodriguez was the right hand of George Herbert Walker Bush, as paymaster and central in Operation 40. And these two were sent down to track down Che Guevara. Felix Rodriguez ordered the assassination of him, and David Morales was the one that actually shot him. Felix Rodriguez is later very central in the whole Iran-Contra scandal, where you got loads of Operation 40 operatives as well, like Barry Seals and many, many other from Operation 40. But this thing with RFK, I tell you, when you look at many of these assassinations, they're like no-brainers. You don't have to be very clever to see that they're not the way they're supposed, that they're being served us. You know, like you have Sirhan, the guy who's still to this very day in prison for having shot him. The closest he got to Robert Kennedy was a meter, 1 meter 30. And as soon as he started shooting, people jumped him and they put him down on a steam table and got the gun from him, even though he was still trying to shoot and so on. So, of course, Robert Kennedy was shot 3 times straight from the front. Absolutely not. He was shot point blank from the back and to the right. Nowhere and at no time were Sirhan anywhere close to be behind and to the right of Robert Kennedy. And when you look at different evidence, it looks like there's somewhere between 12 and 13 shots fired. Now, the revolver Sirhan had was only had eight bullets. So, you know, it's not very hard to understand. There must have been at least one more shooter. And then you have the massive whole cover-up of they burnt all the photos, evidence, destroyed the whole thing. Well, that's standard procedures after these conspiracies. So Robert Kennedy, absolute assassination, and not by a lone crazy guy. I just want to mention also that if you take John Lennon, for instance, mm-hmm. the night that he was shot, because the main common thing you have with these people that are taking out, it's very, very sad, actually, because people like Gandhi, Lady Diana, John Lennon, Bob Marley, JFK, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, they all stood for non-violence, more or less, you know, that they wanted a peaceful world, a world in unity, the way normal people wanted. And this is when they become a problem for this global elite, because their agenda is brutal death and destruction, war, making billion and get total control. So John Lennon, he was another one that was a real boil in the butt for them, because he was somebody who stood up for peace, who sang and talked about love and peace and don't go to war, stop the whole madness. They managed to push him down for quite a few years through the FBI and so on. J. Edgar Hoover hated him, absolutely hated him. But it came to a point in the late 70s where he decided to make a comeback. And he and Yoko had just recorded the comeback album. They were planning a big peace tour in Europe and the States, beginning in the States. So this was once again a major problem for them, because here they had again somebody who people really listened to in the millions. So you go to the crime scene, and I always use what I call Farmer Brown logic, you know, normal logic, like 1 + 1 = 2. If somebody says 1 + 1 = 37, I know they're lying. It doesn't matter if they got a fancy laboratory coat on with a long title and they can show the whole thing in 3D animation. If they still try to tell me that it's 37, I know there's a lie. And I know there's a reason why they're lying. And if you track that lie backwards, you will come to the real truth sooner or later. So you come to this crime scene. The official story is that Mark Chapman, the guy who's still in prison for this, was standing to the right. The limo came, stopped outside the Dakota building. Yoko Ono left, then John came a few meters after her and was on the way into the building when suddenly a series of shots were fired. John went down, Yoko came out screaming, John crawled into the building, and they took him to hospital and he was pronounced dead. They say that the doorman ran over, grabbed the gun from Chapman and screamed, "You just shot Lennon, you just shot Lennon." After that, Chapman just went into like a zombie, which is a very known state of mind-controlled people. They sometimes they use these mind control not as assassins because they cannot be trusted to carry it out professionally, but to take the fall for it. And so you look at the crime, the evidence and so on. So, of course, John Lennon was shot from the back and to the right where Chapman was standing. Absolutely not. All shots fired hit him straight from the left and very, very accurate. Very, you know, they were so close together, some of the shots, that it was hard to track if there was more than one bullet fired. So I would say a fair question would be to say, who was standing to the left? Mm-hmm. Fair question.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this evening, it was a doorman by the name of José Perdomo. You track this doorman. He disappeared right after the assassination into oblivion. So, I mean, you just hear him being mentioned as the doorman. But I heard his name just, you know, the minutes after the shooting. So, and it was just because I recognized the name that I noticed, because it took like 7 years before this name surfaced again. And José Perdomo, for 10 years, he was one of the top officers in Operation 40. Now, go figure the chances of one of the top assassins in the States working extra as a doorman that evening. Could be a coincidence. I think not.
So you have these disparate assassinations, seemingly not connected, but according to your point of view and what you found, if you look deeper in, that they are connected. So the question is, and we don't expect you to give us the whole answer because it's a huge topic, but what kind of forces are behind these kind of movements, and what is their goal?
As far as I've been able to find out, it's a small, they call themselves the elite. I would call them the minority or the likeless, because there's so few. There are only a couple of thousand, you know. And I think it's an absolute joke that we're in this situation, because we are, the last time I checked it, about 7 billion people, you know. So it's an absolute joke, the whole thing. But it is like a cancer growth in a beautiful, alive body. And if we don't expose this cancer growth, it will kill the body in the end. Their agenda is a one-world global fascist state. They want it. That's why they're trying to, you know, in the old days, you had the world looking like a mirror ball, like a disco ball. All countries, you know, strong in themselves, having the whole structure where they could be independent as sovereign and so on. This is what they're trying to knock out country by country by country in different, they've got different tactics of how to knock out a country. And their task is, or their aim is, to create a one world, like a crystal ball, no borders, but a totally one world fascist state with a one world army. That would be the NATO and the UN troops together, not to defend us, but to control us. A one world digital currency, very dangerous in my opinion, because today if your credit card doesn't work or you want to pay for something, you can just pick up your notes and coins and pay with that.
Sure.
Once that's disappeared, when that is not available anymore, the one who controls your credit card or your chip or whatever it's going to be can just say, well, I'm very sorry, Jim, you're off. And they just turn you off, and you have no ability. They can shut you down. And they want a microchip population. They've done it now in the army. They're microchipping them in prisons. And now it's becoming more and more, you know, VIP clubs. You know, you can get a chip. You know, you're the only one who can get in here. I would very much warn for that as well. It is very, very dangerous, these things. And what do they want more? They also, I'm very sorry to be the bringer of bad news if you were not aware of it, but they would very much like to get rid of quite a few of us. And that is carried out through, I would say, almost like a secret war going on against our immune system. They try to get to us with GMOs, to chemtrails in the air, the water, fluoridated water, absolute crap food and so on, to break down our immune system and get it very, very, our body environment very, very acidic, because it's in the acidic body environment where most diseases can thrive, especially cancers and funguses and these things. So I would very much recommend one way of getting your health back in shape, check out your pH balance and get that up to where it's supposed to be, because once the pH balance is restored in your body, boom, this incredible thing called your immune system, it's an absolute mechanism of magic, kicks in and starts dealing with whatever attacks it. But here, they try to knock that out. And they also try to knock us out with all these horrendous, horrendous vaccines. I beg from the bottom of my heart, do not give your kids or yourself these things. Some of these patents are labeled weapons of mass destruction. They are done on design to knock you out. So please, please, I tell you, we have never vaccinated any of our kids. They've been sick like once or twice their whole life. And you see other children, they get like 26 different shots before they're 2 years old. And they've got all these kind of weird symptoms and all strange diseases. And it's horrendous once you start seeing how it's carried out. And also check out the ownership of these companies that do these. You know, check out, have these been tested? No. All of these swine flu things they come up with so that they justify pumping all this crap into your body. Please, please be aware of it. Because the vaccines, what they do, the body is made so beautifully that there's multiple layers. You can't get into where it's really vulnerable. You got the skin and different tissues down there. But with a needle, you just bypass all these security barriers in your body and just pump it right in there. And that is an awful thing to do.
Well, it has been a fascinating bit of time we've been able to spend with you. Ole, where can people go to tune into everything it is you do, all your research? Where can they go on the net?
My website, of course, Light on Conspiracy. It's a very handpicked name because I believe in total exposure, you know, put the spotlight on them. I'm not here to spread fear or hatred or anger in any way. I am here to do my utmost to fearlessly expose them and to make it stop, you know, make this madness stop. Because this world is designed for absolute harmony, beauty, balance, all of these things. And there's this bully in the neighborhood messing it up for all of us. So expose it and make it stop. I've written several books. One of my books is called Coup d'etat in slow motion. It's about this assassination of the Swedish prime minister, but also with all the different, it's connected with the JFK assassination, the Iran-Contra scandal, illegals, arms trading, Freemasonry networks, you name it, it's there. And also it's almost 1,100 pages. The last 200 pages is just membership list of the so-called Bilderberg group. The members, the locations where they've secretly met, the agenda that has leaked out, and so on. Because it's by exposing these hidden networks, that is the way you will start seeing that not only are these crimes connected on a street level by the mechanics, but they're actually connected from where the order comes from. These are not separate events. They are, I would say, so many of them are connected.
Well, thank you, Ole. I appreciate it. It's been a fascinating 50 minutes or so, and folks can check it all out at lightonconspiracies.com. Thank you for joining us today.
I tell you, Jim, anytime you want me back, you know, my head is full of this. Just use me, get it out there, and let it do good.
Thanks so much, and thanks to you for tuning in to the Conspiracy Corner. We certainly appreciate it, and we'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye, everybody.